This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday, so let's get straight to our week in review, starting with a damning new report out today on the Department of Children and Families' mishandling of the case of a 7-year-old Hardwick boy.
The boy has been in a coma since mid-July after his father allegedly beat him and starved him. Today's report found that at least 16 DCF staff, doctors, teachers, and guidance counselors knew about problems in the family. But as Governor Charlie Baker put it today, the state failed to protect the child.
I'm not going to stand here and say there are no systemic issues here, okay? I'm going to stand here and say that we are in the process of dealing with an agency that has many systemic problems, and we're going to fix them.
Joining us now to talk about the problems at DCF, the report, and the rest of the week's news is columnist for the Boston Globe, Dante Ramos. Hey, Dante, good to have you.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Shira Springer, sports reporter with the Globe. Welcome back, Shira.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's just start, first of all, with this report on the DCF out just this afternoon. I mean, it is incredibly damning. Basically, it says that there are, as you heard Charlie Baker say earlier, systemic failures across DCF, any one of which could have led to what we saw happen to the 7-year-old Hardwick boy, but all of them in combination seem to scream at a state agency in dire need of help. Dante, let's start with your reaction.
The impression I got from reading the report is that DCF workers are essentially being forced to make gut judgments about problems because the policies of the agency haven't been updated for many years, and there's a lot of confusion about, you know, when removing a child is actually called for. And then they're also suffering from a lot of incomplete information. It's striking in the report that DCF, even as they were working with the father in this case, in order to improve his parenting, had never conducted an assessment of his ability to be a parent in the first place.
Even after he himself had said he wondered about his ability to do so.
Exactly.
Mm. Shira, your first responses?
It was not only damning, but also heartbreaking that there were so many opportunities at which DCF could have intervened, could have, you know, put up a, you know, red flag could have been put up, and somebody could have come to this child's rescue. You mentioned the inability of the parent, the father to parent, the communication lapses. I mean, I'm astounded by the number of people who were involved in this case and the number of reports that were filed and the number of people who are saying, I think there's something wrong here. He's coming to school with bruises. I mean, lots and lots of signs that something was very, very wrong and that nobody put the puzzle together and acted is heartbreaking. And you know, and another aspect of it was you also get a feeling of just how overwhelmed DCF is with its cases and just this inability to put things together comes from that.
Well, let's hear a little bit more about what Governor Baker had to say about that. Shira, you mentioned the number of people and interactions that DCF did have with this family. Governor Baker touched upon that as well. Here he is.
110 visits. So many eyes on the child. Nobody putting the whole picture together. It certainly implies systemic failures.
And in fact, the report goes into even more detail, saying that the boy and his father had been receiving services through DCF for the 5 months prior to the boy's hospitalization. No fewer than 16 DCF staff, 8 children's behavioral health initiative professionals, community providers, a neuropsychologist, teachers, guidance counselors, all of these people interacting with the family. And then the report goes on to say, though, that rather than increasing child safety, however, this fact, so many eyes on the child, may have actually diffused responsibility and decision-making. So here's what Mary Lou Sutters had to say about that. She's Health and Human Secretary's Services for the Commonwealth.
And I think one of the takeaways for us is that many eyes on a family, the visibility does not actually connote to safety.
So, Dante, there was another aspect of the report that really caught my attention. It does mention, yes, increased caseload growth, especially in the Worcester area where this happened, budget fluctuations as well. But it really goes straight to the heart of another matter that I think hasn't maybe received as much attention. It says quite clear that DCF does not have the policy framework, the operating rules, and the executional... if I say that properly, follow through that is required to properly serve and protect and support all children with which it is involved. I mean, they were talking about procedures that are 12 or 15 years old that haven't been updated at DCF, for example.
Exactly. And the ability of an agency that is deploying modern technology and modern risk assessment methods to do good for children is, I mean, it's obviously better if you have all of these tools at your disposal. And it was a more of a slipshod type of operation. For me, the most disturbing part of the report was the suggestion that DCF was receiving multiple reports about this child and about his interaction with the father. And there were situations where, because they were receiving many reports, they assumed that problems were being taken care of and that any issues that might have arisen were already being addressed. And it just showed that, no, actually another possibility is that the abuse is intensifying.
Right. And in fact, later on in the report, they say that, for example, many of DCF's current resources and policies focus on children in the department's custody already, not those who are living at home. Sure, you're shaking your head.
Yeah, that was something that jumped out at me in the report as well, that they have all these resources dedicated to caring for kids that have been taken out of the home, and yet the supervision of what's happening in the home and the ability to assess what's happening in the home, there are just no resources for that. And yet most of the kids who are being looked after by DCF are actually in the home and not being taken out. So it would seem like a misallocation of resources is part of the systemic issue that's
right
there.
So let's play one more cut from this afternoon's press conference with Governor Baker. He said that there are recommendations for the courts about child custody cases. And he says the report includes recommendations that talk about assessing the capability of parents and making sure that each child has a court representative.
If you can do it administratively, do it. If you can't do it administratively and you need a statutory change, tell us what it is. We'll be happy to file it, support it, and work with you and advocate for it.
Dante, quick last question to you about DCF. Governor Baker earlier in the past couple of weeks and months has also said that if especially the Worcester area needs more money, he said he's going to be willing to find it. So do you see the governor setting himself up here to actually make some pretty significant changes within DCF?
I would think so. If you read the report, it's very much the type of report you would expect a Charlie Baker administration to produce. It's focused on the nuts and bolts of things. It has a long list of administrative and policy type changes that might be made. So this certainly would be a prologue to, you know, an increase in resources for that area.
All right, well, let's move on and talk about another big story that made news this week, and that's the Patriots and Deflategate. Their star quarterback, Tom Brady, of course, is free to play football, thanks to a federal judge in New York who threw out his 4-game suspension for his alleged involvement in Deflategate. Judge Richard Berman may now be among the most popular men in New England, as Pats fans, including Governor Charlie Baker, applauded his decision.
I'm glad it's over, and I agree with the judge's decision. I mean, I like a lot of fans, and as a private citizen, I read a bunch of the reports, I watched a lot of the news stuff, and came to the conclusion that I don't think there's much there.
So Judge Berman's decision came down to a couple of key ideas. One of them, that the NFL can't punish Brady for general awareness of other people's conduct. And he said Commissioner Roger Goodell tried to dispense his own brand of industrial justice. Shira, you and I talked about this story a lot yesterday when it broke. What have you been thinking about it over the last 24 hours or so?
I've been thinking about taking in all the reaction from all corners. I mean, you got to love, you know, you've got Donald Trump, you know, throwing in with Tom Brady and saying what a great guy he is. And, you know, I'm a great friend of Tom Brady.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I actually think that might be a bad thing for Tom Brady. And I think it sort of caught some New England football fans off guard. And then I think another interesting fallout from this is that Roger Goodell, the commissioner, will not be going to Gillette Stadium for the season opener where the Patriots will be awarded or the championship banner will be lifted. And
can you blame him, though?
I can't blame him, but I think part of the, you know, Judge Berman's ruling should have mandated that he attend this game, because my
face
feeling is
music.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Exactly. You created this mess. You overreached. You were judge, jury, and executioner, and now you have to pay for the consequences. You know, and that's only a stadium full of boos. When if this had gone another way, you would have potentially ruined a player's reputation, and you know his what, you know, what people think of him and his career.
Well, Dante, I want to come to you, but let's listen to Jeffrey Kessler. He's the lawyer for NFL Players Association who represented Tom Brady in court. We spoke to him yesterday. He said there were two grounds on which the judge decided to throw out the suspension.
One was the complete lack of notice that any players had, either about ball pressure, being suspended for being generally aware, allegedly, that somebody else did something. Second, the judge found the proceedings were fundamentally unfair.
By the way, we talked about Judge Berman being one of the most popular men in New England. Jeffrey Kessler, too, might be right up there, a candidate for a key to the city of Boston. But, Dante, what do you think of the Judge Berman's ruling?
Well, the thing to remember is that he didn't substantively exonerate Tom Brady on the accusation that, you know, word on the street and at the stadium was that he liked the balls deflated a little bit. That possibility has not been disproven, although, you know, these sort of legal decisions have a way of making people forget that. What interests me about this, actually, and here we are, it's almost Labor Day weekend, and this decision, which involves, you know, a billion-dollar league and an extraordinarily wealthy player, is actually being taken as a victory for labor activists. Because
it's a good point.
Because it
gets multimillionaire to, labor.
Well, it gets to the question of how much authority a boss has over the workplace, even if your workplace is a stadium and even if your boss is the NFL commissioner. So there's a lot of happy people in union land this weekend, and maybe not just in Massachusetts.
I know. Who would have thought that Tom Brady would be a union hero?
There's another aspect of this story that has always troubled me, and we've sort of talked about it a lot, and I think we mentioned it yesterday with you, Shira, and that is this idea that Deflategate, in a funny way, sort of served the NFL in that it allowed them, it gave them all kinds of publicity, but not the kind of publicity that they don't want. For example, players retiring with brain, you know, huge percentage of players retiring with brain damage. But I'm wondering if you think of sort of heightened legal scrutiny on the league might actually open the league up to scrutiny of these other matters as well.
One can only hope, and I actually do think it's headed toward that, because I think what you have here is not just one victory against the NFL. This is now part of a series of victories where players have had suspensions overturned, and you're beginning to see, I think, the tide turn where in the past, a lot of players were fearful in some respect to really take on the NFL. And I think there will be a trickle-down, trickle-over, trickle-up effect to people really putting honest, hard pressure on them about concussions, about domestic violence, and about all the about drug use, about all the issues that the NFL tries to sort of, same thing it did with Deflategate. Again, the judge, jury, executioner, it likes to police itself. And I think we're reaching, hopefully, the end of an era where the NFL, it may still feel it's entitled to police itself, but it now knows that other people are watching.
Well, on that note, should we talk a little bit more health, except the health of the everyday average person here in the Commonwealth? Because another big story this week had to do with how much money we're spending in Massachusetts on health care. The state's Center on Health Information and Analysis found that statewide spending on health care hit $54 billion in 2014 and grew at twice the rate we saw in 2013. So here, once again, is Health and Human Services Secretary Mary Lou Sutters. She spoke to WBUR's Martha Biebinger about those cost increases, and she said part of the problem was a big bump in enrollment in MassHealth.
Obviously, the 19% growth in MassHealth is distressing to all of us, and this administration is taking steps to redesign and restructure a MassHealth program that is sustainable for the long haul. We're not going to always hit the benchmark, but what this does is continues to put a very public spotlight on our needs to really control costs.
Okay, Dante, so we've got a spotlight on something I think we kind of already knew, that costs need to be controlled. Your reaction to the fact that we had this big bump this year?
It is really disappointing, because in recent years it looked as though the trend was improving. It's happening for some good reasons and some bad reasons. One of the vectors of upward growth, if you want to call it that, was prescription drugs. And you know, some of that is because there are great new drugs that are coming on the market. There's one called Sovaldi, which treats hepatitis C and is an amazing drug. It's it essentially cures a condition that people would be receiving lots of health care, maybe get liver transplants. It's an incredibly destructive disease, and this drug solves it. The problem is that the drug is hugely expensive. You know, the hope would be that over the, you know, once enough people take this drug, then they won't need it anymore, mm-hmm. and then the state won't have to pay for as much of it. But, you know, the downside is that there's a lot of drugs like that that come on the market. Hopefully they end up in the long run saving people some, you know, some expenditures. But, you know, we're not really seeing a lot of that at this point.
Right. Shira, your thoughts?
I think I'd have to agree with Dante. I think one of the things that struck me was, I believe it was a 13% rise in pharmaceuticals expenditures. I mean, and obviously the goal is here to control the costs, and you wonder about the long-term sustainability if, you know, costs keep rising and you can't control the pharmaceutical costs and all the other. I think we're spending, was it $8,010 per Massachusetts resident?
Right.
You know, that's an awful lot of money. I believe it's one of the highest, if not the highest,
in the nation.
Mm-hmm. So something has to be done. I was a little it was a little disconcerting to hear some of the experts weigh in on this and say, we don't exactly know what's going on here. We're going to have to dig a little deeper. I'd like to hear some more solid answers about where they see opportunities to control those costs.
Yeah, and one other question that we asked Stuart Altman. He's a professor of health policy at Brandeis and also the chairman of the Massachusetts Health Policy Commission, was about the impact on individuals, because the money's got to come from somewhere, right? Premiums or deductibles. He told us this week that the report also showed that increases weren't actually that high on an individual level.
For the majority of the individuals in our state, the increases were quite moderate. The big increase, though, which led to the fact that overall state spending went up, was for mass health. And there were a number of reasons which are important, so I don't want to downplay them, but they could turn out to be only temporary.
Temporary because one of the reasons was the meltdown of the Connector website. But Dante, I mean, Stuart Altman is a difficult person to quibble with, but I did quibble and do quibble with him a little bit, because we also heard this week that so many more people are being pushed to high deductible plans, for example, or that premiums are rising even if they aren't rising all that much. The point is, I think that it's impossible to escape the fact that as individuals in the Commonwealth, people are feeling this in their pocketbooks.
I think that's right. And unfortunately, the system is only beginning to adapt to the need to bring that down. I don't think high deductible plans, depending upon the way they're designed, are necessarily a terrible thing, and they can have a positive effect in controlling costs. One of the problems is that it depends upon people being able to see the price tag of things. And the healthcare system, the individual elements of it, have not adapted to that need. Barbara Anthony over at the Pioneer Institute did a great study earlier this year where she called around to different hospitals to find out how much this one particular type of MRI would cost. And it took her days to get a straight answer from a lot of hospitals. The answers varied from $500 to $8,000 for the same procedure. So there's an arbitrariness to the whole process that is part of what's driving up costs and keeping them from being contained.
All right. Well, let's move on to the case of Aisling Brady McCarthy, the Irish nanny who spent the last 2.5 years in jail for the death of a one-year-old Cambridge child who was in her care, who was allegedly shaken to death. This week, prosecutors dropped the case after a revised medical examiner's report found the cause of death was undetermined, and Brady McCarthy is now back home in Ireland. Here's Middlesex District Attorney Marion Ryan talking about the decision to drop the charges.
Obviously, you are always would hope that we could make these decisions earlier on in the process. But the information that we received, which we received late last week, we acted on, you know, as expeditiously as possible. You can't act on information until you've received it.
So, Dante, what are the lessons of this case, which, depending on how you look at it, was, as District Attorney Marion Ryan says, you can't act on information until you've received it. On the other hand, a huge miscarriage of justice, 2.5 years in jail for a crime that might not have, that apparently didn't even occur.
Right. I think, on the one hand, it doesn't reflect all that well on the medical examiner's office that they ended up revising their opinion about essentially what caused the death of the child. On the other hand, it is a positive that they ultimately did so, because otherwise this miscarriage of justice would have continued. This has obviously led to questions about shaken baby syndrome, mm-hmm. and that, you know, which was the sort of a popular basis. I hate to use the word popular, but for criminal charges. And the criminal justice system is as subject to changes in, again, I don't want to call it a fad or fashion, but certain types of charges come in and out of vogue. And this was something, a lot of the cases that have been brought up on these particular grounds have ended up seeming a little bit shaky. So I think we're seeing a little bit of a reevaluation of how these types of cases ought to be handled in the future.
Yeah. So this is the second time in less than a year that the medical examiner's office had changed positions on a shaken baby case. And nationally, 16 convictions have been overturned involving shaken baby cases. And we put that question to pediatrician Robert Sagi about this. And he told us that all kinds of convictions get overturned in the justice system. Here's what he said.
So in a situation where we have hundreds and perhaps 1,000 infants a year who experience shaken baby syndrome, the fact that 16 convictions over a multi-year period were overturned lets me know that the justice system worked. It doesn't change anything about whether or not shaken baby syndrome or abusive head trauma exists.
In other words, he says it does exist. It's much more than a fad. But Shira, what did you take away from the story?
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if the justice system worked because, you know, this all happened based on what the defense attorney said, I believe, was the opinion of one doctor. And this decision, mm-hmm. of shaken baby was at fault, was made within 24 hours of the one-year-old coming into Boston Children's Hospital. And I think if the justice system really worked, there would be a part of the justice system that provided for a more thorough investigation when cases of shaken baby or believed cases of shaken baby come up. And that you would have, perhaps you have to have a panel of three pediatricians agree that this is the cause, and that there has to be a more thorough investigation before you indict a person and put them in jail for 2.5 years. And it's also my understanding that 90% of the evidence shown to the grand jury would have been inadmissible at trial. To me, that's not the justice system working. And
points to some real problems.
And 16 convictions being overturned is no small number if you're one of the 16.
Yeah. Dante, did you want to add something?
I did. I think it's, in a way, the flip side of the DCF discussion that we were having earlier, because nobody, obviously, we've seen so many ghastly things happen to children in the state that nobody wants someone who really legitimately has caused harm to a child to escape accountability for that. What this shows is that there's a lot of subjectivity or discretion or judgment that is built into something that we would like to think is more cut and dry than it is.
All right. Well, we have just enough time for our hubbubs, those very brief stories that might have caught the eye of our panelists, but didn't make it to the top of the news. Let's go to you, Shira. What's your hubbub?
Well, I wanted to give the Boston City Council a round of applause. On Wednesday, the council unanimously voted to ban smokeless tobacco and other tobacco products at pro and amateur sports venues. That includes Fenway Park. The ban will go into effect April 1st of 2016, just in time for opening day. This is a very big step because young athletes admire and emulate what the pros do, and a lot of pros in baseball have made smokeless tobacco popular chewing tobacco. I think it's going to head off these kids going from smokeless tobacco to actual smoking. And more than that, it's, you know, smokeless tobacco puts you at risk for pancreatic cancer, oral cancer, esophageal cancer. Doing the right thing. Yay for the three cheers for the Boston City Council.
All right. Dante, how about you?
Boston renters are used to seeing a relentless upward trajectory in prices. The Globe reported this week that the construction of upscale new buildings like the Ink Block in Troy, Boston, is forcing owners of brownstones in the South End and the Back Bay to lower what they're asking for. Imagine that. Supply and demand works. Build, baby, build.
But only if the rents are only going down if you can afford thousands of dollars to begin with. So I see this as the 1% benefiting yet again.
It'll work its way through the system.
Oh, said with such confidence. We'll see if that confidence is disearned. Because I think that same Globe story said the pressure is as high as ever on on the rents that the rest of us pay.
All right, Meghna, what about your hobby?
Sorry, Dante. Just, I'm really sensitive about
housing
issues.
I didn't know there was a critique
issues.
Involved.
Just housing issues. They just get to me. Okay, I actually have definitely a serious hubbub this week, mostly because, you know, it's been a tough week for children and families in the news. And we found out this week that there was, the 2-year-old girl in Auburn who previously had died in foster care. Well, her mother, Jessica Conway, was found dead this week as well. And although nothing has been confirmed yet, Jessica Conway's father said that it's likely due to a drug overdose. He's quoted in the Globe as saying that his daughter's addiction, which caused her to lose her child to DCF custody and foster care, was due to heroin. He said the reason all of the problems in her life happened was because of heroin. So, you know, first a girl is removed from a mother, and then the mother is found dead. It just once again reminded me of how deeply tragic the heroin epidemic in Massachusetts is, and how it really is just damaging a lot of families, not just individuals.
Important and sad story. So I'm going to endeavor to lighten the mood to end this week in review with this hubbub. We've heard a lot about how successful the cleanup of the Charles River has been. Once the water was too dangerous to even touch, then the cleanup started. It became safe to boat in. Then you could swim in it. This week, we learned that it's apparently good enough to brew beer with. And I love this story. Boston-based Harpoon Brewery is making a beer with Charles River water. This is true. It's teaming up with a Newton-based water desalination company to make a special brew that's been dubbed Charles River Pale Ale. There's going to be a limited amount available when they finally get it done at Harpoon's Beer Hall to taste. But there it is. Charles River Pale Ale to end our week in review.
Would you drink it?
Oh, I'll try it. Sure.
Yeah, you need to next week in review, you need samples.
Well, okay. We're going to go out there and try it. I think that's a field piece we've got to do.
Well, Dante Ramos, columnist for the Boston Globe, thanks so much for joining us. And no hard feelings, just housing issues. They get to me.
Great to be here. No grudges.
And Shira Springer, sports reporter of the Boston Globe. Shira, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
There's more in the moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.